iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your free support, your free people-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Here we are on KBOO Portland, and here it is, Boxing Day. I'd like to change that to Box In a Billionaire Day. But I have news. And today I'd like to concentrate on the fact that the climate is screwed. Not will be screwed or might be screwed. It's screwed, and things have changed and continue to change at a rapid rate. So I have various articles on that. The first one is from Al Jazeera America, Dateline Lawrence, Kansas. They write, "It's no longer as corny as Kansas in August. Now it's cotton, okra, and sorghum. The hotter summers and more intense and frequent droughts in the Midwest are forcing farmers here to forego their plants of their grandparents' generation and look down south for inspiration." Quoting, "We kept trying to grow sustainable tomatoes, but it was so hot that the plants got stressed and they wouldn't produce fruit." According to Courtney Skiba, who started Homestead Ranch in the small town of Lecompton, Kansas, a decade ago. "By the end of the season," she says, "when it did get wetter and cooler, it was too late, so that's when we started planting okra." She's not the only one. It's the time of year when the farmers look back at the summer and plan for planting ahead, and what they see is a lot of hot and a lot of dry. That's why okra, once a plant squarely rooted in southern cooking, is headed north, way north. Farmers in Wisconsin are planting okra as well. And just departing from that script, I want to comment that that's why I say it's already happened. Climate change has happened, and no one knows better than the people who have to act pragmatically on what is on the ground. Farmers don't say, "Oh, I think maybe this will happen soon and then plant a crop." No, they look at what is happening on the ground, what their ground will grow, they plant that. Because if they don't, well, they become very hungry and homeless farmers. Returning to that article from Al Jazeera, agriculture specialists say two things are happening. Temperatures are rising and the water table is dropping. The summer of 2012 was the third hottest summer on record for the U.S. according to the National Climatic Blah Blah Center, and 2013 had record-breaking heat waves. At the same time, little rain fell. Much of Kansas, Missouri, Arkansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma suffered drought in the exceptional or worst category in 2012. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, the region remained dry throughout much of 2013, rivaling the Dust Bowl years. Corn wouldn't pollinate. Tomatoes crashed. Broccoli withered. So farmers started looking for hardy plants that could handle the 100-degree spells in July and August. Once again, departing from the text, I remember on the rare occasion that I grew things in Texas when I lived there, yeah, it would be okra. Okra did pretty well in Texas. Returning to the article, the heat affected not just the plants. It was so dry last year, Skiba said. Her goats went into heat months earlier and had kids in December. Goats usually give birth in March or April, and then a second set at the end of June. She and her partner, Denise, kept some, sold some, and processed others for meat. It was so dry for so long, and everything was so stressed out, it triggered them to go into cycle earlier, she said. Chuck Rice, chair of the International Union of Soil Sciences Division, on the role of soils in sustaining society and the environment, says that it has been so hot in the Midwest that sometimes the pollen on the corn goes stale and the plant doesn't fertilize. There has been a 60% reduction in crop yields in some areas, he said. Farmers are planting sorghum instead, which can be used for cattle feed. Talking about climate change on the ground in the United States, in the gardens and in the farms. Other farmers are switching to an entirely different crop, cotton, because it uses significantly less water. We're seeing the expansion of cotton into the Midwest. It's already in the southern tier of Kansas, he said. I see cotton coming. These changes aren't a perfect switch. Cotton produces less ground cover than corn, so when the harvest is over, the soil is drier and more prone to erosion. And sorghum doesn't yield as much grain as corn does in good conditions. It's only when it's too hot that corn and other crops prove the better bet. Read that one wrong. Sorry about that. It's only when it's too hot that the sorghum proves the better bet. Jerry Hatfield is the laboratory director at U.S. Department of Agriculture National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment in Ames, Iowa. He said there's been a big rise in planting sorghum, and he's seeing increases in Texas, Missouri, and Oklahoma as well. With warmer temperatures, you'll be seeing wider spread adoption of sorghum because it's more tolerant of heat and water stress than corn. So there's more on that article from the source, Al Jazeera. You can find that. Al Jazeera is useful for certain forms of information. I certainly wouldn't count on their Middle East reporting, but continuing with the climate change theme here, Southeast Greenland is a region of high snow accumulation. Researchers now believe that the thick snow cover insulates the aquifer from cold water surface temperatures. By the way, this article is a reference to the fact that liquid water aquifer has been found in Greenland. Surprise! And it is from Climate Change News, and they say this situation allows the water to remain liquid throughout the year. As far as where the water comes from, researchers say the aquifer is fed by meltwater that percolates from the surface during the summer. Researchers used NASA's Operation IceBridge radar data to confine the limits of the water reservoir, which spreads over 27,000 square miles, an area larger than the state of West Virginia. Laura Koenig, a glaciologist with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, and her team measured the top of the aquifer at about 39 feet under the surface. This is the depth at which the boreholes filled with water after extracting the ice cores. The team estimated water volume of about 154 billion tons. If this water was to suddenly discharge into the ocean, this would correspond to 4/10 of a millimeter of sea level rise. Our next big task, they say, is to understand how this aquifer is filling and how it's discharging, said Koenig. The aquifer could offset some sea level rise if it's storing water for long periods of time. For example, after the 2012 extreme surface melt across Greenland, it appears that the aquifer filled a little bit. The question now is, how does that water leave the aquifer on its way to the ocean, and whether it will leave this year or 100 years from now? There's more on that at NASA as well. And I also want to comment that there's something that's not being said here, and that is, how much is that liquid water getting down to the bottom of the glacier? And we know that it is doing that to some extent. And how much is it moving the glacier, or how much is it likely to accelerate the glacier into the sea? Because when you're talking about sea level rise, and when you're talking about revealing soil as opposed to ice, which reflects heat so much better, the motion of the glacier is everything. If these glaciers in Greenland substantially slide into the sea over the next few years, that will produce a very substantial sea level rise, not the sort that you'll be measuring with little yardsticks. No, that's the sort of sea level rise that you measure by getting the hell out of the way. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch. I've been talking about for years how there is an acceleration in the acceleration of news on climate change. And so that is my theme today, and I have more on that. And some of the best that I have on it is by Dar Jamal. And I picked that up just a few days ago and want to share it with you. Dar Jamal writes, the more conservative climate science types, represented by the prestigious International Governmental Panel on Climate Change, paint scenarios that are hair-raising. But he says, let's spend a little time with what might be called scientists at the edge and hear what they have to say. The title is, We've Never Been Here as a Species. We, as a species, have never experienced 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That's quoting Guy McFarson, a professor emeritus of evolutionary biology, natural resources, and ecology at the University of Arizona, and a climate change expert of 25 years. He said, we've never been on a planet with no Arctic ice, and we will hit the average of 400 parts per million within a couple of years. At that time, we will also see the loss of Arctic ice in the summers. This planet has not experienced an ice-free Arctic for at least the last 3 million years. For the uninitiated, In the simplest terms, here's what an ice-free Arctic would mean when it comes to heating the planet. Minus the reflective ice cover on the Arctic waters, solar radiation would be absorbed, not reflected, by the Arctic Ocean. That would heat those waters and hence the planet further. This has the effect, the potential, to change global weather patterns, vary the flow of winds, and even someday alter the position of the jet stream. Polar jet streams are fast-flowing rivers of wind positioned high in the Earth's atmosphere that push cold and warm air masses around, playing a critical role in determining the weather of our planet. McPherson, who maintains the blog Nature Bats Last, added, "We've never been here as a species, and the implications are truly dire and profound for our species and the rest of the living planet." Now, the reason I'm bringing up Dar Jamal's summary here is that he brings together some things that I would like to have had time to bring together. For example, when I talk about that acceleration and the acceleration, what are those figures exactly? I remember them. I remember that the predictions keep getting more dire, and yet they keep coming true and faster than was said so. That's what I mean by the acceleration and the acceleration. Well, Dar Jamal has done that in his article, and you can look it up. Jamail is his last name. And the article that he has written is, let's see, where did I get this particular one? It's on Counterpunch, I believe. And I would like to invite your calls as to what to do about this. I would like to suggest immediate political pressure, political change, make this a huge political issue to immediately reverse global climate change. And the reason I want that is as I see it, as carefully as I can look this over, we have now approached the point where 2014 will be so full of climate disasters that in order to save lives, and indeed in order to save our civilization, we need to take political power to the extent that we can wrest it from the billionaires who really don't give a damn or who profit from climate change, and we need to take action ourselves. So if you have something to say about that, the number to call, 503-231-8187. That's 503 area code here in Oregon. And the number to call, 231-8187, 503-231-8187. Talking about climate change, what to do about it, how to push our politicians, or maybe just get some new politicians or a new system. I'm talking about revolution here, and stop this global disaster. British scientist John Nissen, chairman of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, I emphasize the word emergency group, suggests that if the summer sea ice loss passes the point of no return and catastrophic Arctic methane feedbacks kick in, we'll be in an instant planetary emergency. And departing from the text, that is why I'm suggesting that we are approaching in 2014. Returning to the text, McPherson, Wadham, and Nissen represent just the tip of a melting iceberg, of scientists who are now warning us about looming disaster, especially involving Arctic methane releases. In the atmosphere, methane is a greenhouse gas that, on a relatively short-term time scale, is far more destructive than carbon dioxide. It is 23 times as powerful as CO2 per molecule on a 100-year time scale, 105 times more potent when it comes to heating the planet on a 20-year time scale. And the Arctic permafrost, onshore and off, is packed with methane. The seabed, says Wadham, is offshore permafrost, but is now warming and melting. We are now seeing great plumes of methane bubbling up in the Siberian Sea, millions of square miles where a methane cover is being released. Once again, I depart from the text and say, years ago, starting actually in 94, I came on the airs, came on the air here at KBOO, and began to promote articles talking about this sort of thing. And my attitude back then was, this may be a thin possibility, but we don't have the right to risk it. And we wouldn't want our great-great-great-grandchildren to run the risk of this runaway global warming, this methane gun or clathrate gun, whatever you want to call it, which has a potential of very, very rapidly melting things. Because the way it works is, this methane, you get to the point where the methane gets released. The methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, so it releases more methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas, so it releases more methane. And this is where we are at now. It's happening. The methane disaster is happening now. I can't emphasize that enough. It may be reversible and it may not. Who knows? It's not time to give up. We're still breathing. Returning to the article, according to a study just published in Nature Geoscience, twice as much methane as previously thought is being released from the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, a 2 million square kilometer area off the coast of northern Siberia. Its researchers found that at least 17 teragrams, 1 million tons of methane are being released in the atmosphere each year, where a 2010 study had found only 7 teragrams heading into the atmosphere. That's 7 teragrams to 17 teragrams, and I'll bet you anything, as we speak, it's up. The day after Nature Geoscience released its study, a group of scientists from Harvard and other leading academic institutions published a report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences showing that the amount of methane being emitted in the United States, both from oil and agricultural operations, could be 50% greater than the previous estimates and 1.5 times higher than estimates of the Environmental Protection Agency. Your number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and I believe James is on the air.
Good morning, Teresa. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to preface by saying I know virtually nothing about the climate change debate, just kind of on the surface is what I've been looking at. And I'm looking at a perspective from the trying to keep track of what the banksters are doing. And they are crafty, as you well know. And it is my view, and I don't know this for sure, but I think that they bought the science, the climate of science change debate. And I think it's just another, they've created factions, and they've pit them against one another, and they're profiting off of these factions.
Well, they're also profiting off rushing to the now increasingly ice-free Arctic with icebreakers so that they can draw more methane in a burnable form, in other words, and more oil and gas from beneath the Arctic. And so Gazprom and Shell, at least, and probably others, and of course all of the speculators, all the billionaires who like to throw their money into that, are happy about climate change because they can draw profits from underneath ice that is no longer there.
Right, right. It's very complicated. Like I said, I'm focusing on other stuff, but this is good. Like, you know, it's really good that I think I'm seeing more and more that the left and the right is coming together, because this is so big that all these things, we need to talk about them and sort through them.
Yeah, this isn't left or right. This is human survival. I mean, one,
it is.
If the logical end of the methane gun is that most of the methane is released, and that is so much gas that it literally displaces oxygen. One estimate is that oxygen available to human beings and every other critter on the planet would be reduced simply by displacement to an amount similar to that found at 16,000 feet up a mountain. So if you like breathing,
well,
you're against this sort of phenomenon.
There is a video going around. It gives another perspective. It's on YouTube, called "The Great Global Warming." Is it "The Great Global Warming Hoax"? I suggest you check it out and at least look at what the scientists who are saying that don't buy into it. And another thing is that CO2 is something that we exhale. And that would give, if the banksters can regulate what we exhale, they own us completely.
Are you honestly calling up and saying that it might be a revelation to me that I'm exhaling CO2?
No, I'm just pointing out the fact that if they have the power to regulate it, it gives them the power legislative power to kill you.
Well, that's kind of oxygen saying that we need, but all right. Thank you very much for that contribution. I have to tell you that anything that's saying at this point that global warming is a hoax, that'd be at this point like saying gravity is a hoax. No, sorry, I'm experiencing it, so I'm not going to go there. But thanks for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Gravity, conspiracy or a hoax? How serious is the potential global methane buildup? Not all scientists think it's an immediate threat, or even the major threat we face. But Ira Leifer, an atmospheric and marine scientist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and one of the authors of the recent Arctic methane study, pointed out to Dar Jamal that the Permian mass extinction that occurred 250 million years ago is related to methane and thought to be a key to what caused the extinction of most species on the planet. In that extinction episode, it is estimated that 95% of all species were wiped out. And here is what they said as they died, and I quote, also known as the Great Dying, it was triggered by a massive lava flow in the area of Siberia that led to an increase in global temperatures of 6 degrees Celsius that in turn caused the melting of frozen methane deposits under the seas, releasing the atmosphere. It caused temperatures to skyrocket further. All of this occurred over a period of approximately 80,000 years. We are currently in the midst of what scientists call the sixth mass extinction in planetary history, with between 150 and 200 species going extinct daily, a pace 1,000 times greater than natural background extinction rate. This event may be comparable to or even exceed both the speed and intensity of the Permian mass extinction. The difference being that ours is human caused, isn't going to take 80,000 years, has so far lasted just a few centuries, and is now gaining speed in a non-linear fashion. There's that phrase again. The one that I've been rendering as the acceleration in the acceleration, folks. Are you enjoying breathing? That's how bad this crisis is. I like it. Well, I had all kinds of breathing this morning. Oh, yeah. Good stuff. I like that oxygen. And I just want to comment that I believe that the appropriate attitude towards this would be that we, for the sake of life, and for our children's lives and our grandchildren's lives, will now stop global dominance and its oil-fueled methane extinction, because that's what we're facing now. And the snow and the storms that are swirling around harder because there's more energy in the atmosphere. And the droughts are worse because there's more energy in the atmosphere. That's what global warming means. And thermodynamics means in a vast and complex, rotating and heated on one side atmospheric system with ground heating, the results may vary. So you can get snowed on and you're still experiencing global warming. For those of you who are now getting a little irritated at me for being Captain Obvious, then I point to you, those who will accept absolutely no facts or logic so that they may scream that there is no global warming. And that it's all a hoax. That group, bless you. You know, I would share a cookie with you. I'm not all that mad at you, but I'm not taking you seriously. Oh, no. No, I want to talk to people who are ready to take direct action in any form, from education to laying their lives on the line, just like those people who are out there with the mega load trying to prevent it traveling from Oregon and Idaho and into Canada, where it is set to extract oil shale at a tremendous rate and worsen global warming and worsen pollution. Those people are saints, and they're in the right to block that mega load. And my heart goes out to them, and I thank them sincerely. And I think you should all thank the mega load protesters. And don't accept anything putting them down, saying they're just yahoos or they don't know what they're doing. They are stopping the mega load, and that is the right thing to do. And we should be stopping everything relating to global warming, and I mean in a collective sense. We should be stopping commuting. And there are many ways to do that in an acute sense. We can have days of general strike that stop commuting. And that would be a glorious thing. Because imagine how nice it would be to walk out on the streets and there's no cars, set up a table and have a party. And imagine how nice it would be if we banned commuting and started setting up transparent, cooperative ways of getting to and from our workplaces that would involve changing where the workplace is. That's the easiest thing. Instead of changing all of our housing, we just force the workplace out to where we live, and then you can walk to work. We don't have to commute. That's a crazy idea that's been put in our head, and it's been held in place by the idea that it's normal. It's not normal to commute. It's a way of selling cars. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Roman's on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Roman.
Oh, I already said when I was off the air, but I will say it again. I live in Portland since 77, came from what used to be Soviet Union, and I'm much more conservative in my views than you guys are, but nevertheless, your shows quite often present very valid and good points. But what I want to say in the area of global warming and methane, you guys need to concentrate more on China and Russia, because anybody who knows geography knows about huge marshes in Siberia, which would produce methane. Also, Russia and China are much worse than United States or Canada in environment treatment. China is the biggest producer of pollution in the world now, and it's not even absolutely industrial. So
I have to agree that a global response is necessary. I agree with you there. And
well,
as far as
not only that, I'm not saying just global response, but what I am saying that in shows like this, you know, United States or Canada, for example, don't do enough. Agree. However, they do much more and much better in protecting environment than China or Russia. And I believe that you guys are good station. And what you need to do in shows like this, you need to give more attention, more time to Russia and China.
KBOO Community Radio.
Especially, you know, progressive folks like you, they will stop buying Chinese-made stuff. And then maybe China will not be as abusive to environment as it is.
I hear that
States,
because, yeah, it's U.S. capitalists that are encouraging the pollution paradigm in China. And, you know, we could stop that by various ways. We could certainly ban their imports. And another thing we could do, I mean, that's more drastic and immediately, and it might be time for this, is simply to cut off the debt to China. That would infuriate them and also break them and stop their production, which would stop pollution. Yep, it's time for desperate measures, and I encourage you to form a gang and to do so right now. If you know two people that agree with you and are ready to take political action, you have a gang. A gang moving together can learn how to form a work cooperative or an action cooperative. An action cooperative working together can be part of a movement. You have the power in your hands. You have the power to undertake change right now, but don't do it by yourself. Don't fall for individualism. Work with somebody else right now, and don't be doing it online. Well, stay tuned, because Linda Olsen Osterlund is coming up, and you know that you're going to get good information from that. So stay tuned for the Radio Zine on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On January 14th, the documentary The House I Live In explores the risks that prohibition poses to freedom and the tragedy of addicts being treated as criminals. Meanwhile, the prisons of America are growing overcrowded with nonviolent criminals, and illegal drugs are still being sold in schoolyards. This film is being shown on January 14th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
My first time ever on the radio was on KBOO about 10 years ago on the Soundbox with Dina B. And I've been doing radio ever since. I love KBOO.
KBOO is such a friendly, laid-back, fun environment. There's a lot of freedom here.
Boy, all I can say is that they just give me the complete freedom to play every single thing I feel like playing, and that's a rare thing in radio stations nowadays, and I sure appreciate it.
It's a passion of mine to investigate and to find and to share.
Come on down to the next volunteer orientation on Wednesday, January 8th from 7 to 9 p.m. here at the KBOO Studios at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Yeah.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look here on KBOO. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. Today, we come to the end of the year, and we're coming towards the end of the year, and we're going to be taking a look back at one of the most important developments of 2013. I'm calling it the Year of the Whistleblower, but it could have been called The Empire Exposed, the Year the Empire Was Exposed. My guest is going to guide us in this retrospective is Carl Massinio. He's the co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. The PCJF is a public interest legal organization. Their motto is defending democracy and civil rights in the courts and in the streets. I asked Carl to join us because the PCJF has played an important role in exposing our government's undemocratic actions through freedom of information requests and lawsuits and demonstrations. They were the first to reveal the hand of the Homeland Security behind the Occupy crackdowns and followed with lawsuits about the Brooklyn Bridge entrapment by police. They've got an exciting new project going involving bus ads, and we will get to that. Welcome to KBOO, Carl.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you, Linda.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you. I first became aware of your organization back with the Occupy exposures and was so grateful that you existed. And we used here at KBOO the information that was revealed to do many stories. So thank you for that.
Well, it's been our pleasure to work with you over that period of time.
Yeah. I called this year the Year of the Whistleblowers. And for me, it really started with the trial of Chelsea Manning. I know the year didn't start that way, and I know that's not everybody's way of looking at it. But in terms of whistleblowing, she played such an important role in the release of the information and the video of the helicopter killing innocent people, the U.S. helicopter. And then her trial, her dignity.